coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media.
I would ask that if that is out of order, and please refrain from the comments.
The debate over repealing Delaware's death penalty was center stage this week, with a House committee blocking a repeal bill. Political reporter James Dawson offers an in-depth look at where things stand on the issue. Also, efforts to reshape Claymont and Wilmington's riverfront have both been going on for years. We look at how far each has come. And Charlie Irons grew up on Bowers Beach during the 40s and 50s, when it was a premier fishing town on Delaware Bay. He remembers it as small-town America at its best.
You had kids playing in the street. You had your baseball teams. You had your Boy Scout troop. If you got in trouble, your parents knew it before you got home, because everybody knew everybody's kids, you know.
In Enlighten Me, a glimpse back at Bowers Beach history ahead of the grand reopening of its Maritime Museum and annual Buccaneer Bash. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. That and more is next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The debate over repealing Delaware's death penalty was center stage this week, with proponents of ending capital punishment in the state trying to move legislation forward that would accomplish that goal. The bill already passed the state Senate by a slim margin earlier this year, just as it did 2 years ago when a similar measure was pursued. Now, the bill was back before the House Judiciary Committee, where it previously bogged down. Political reporter James Dawson picks up the story from there.
I would ask that if that is out of order, and please refrain from the comments.
Supporters of a death penalty repeal bill chastised members of the House Judiciary Committee after they blocked the legislation Wednesday. It came down to a 6-5 vote after a nearly 3-hour-long hearing. The result wasn't dramatically different from when the same committee killed a similar bill 2 years ago, despite colleagues not on the committee urging them to send it to the full House. Representative Sean Lynn, one of the chief sponsors, says it's an issue that warrants debate among all elected officials, not just on the 11-member committee.
I am disappointed that, you know, there's an overarching kind of transparency and government issue here, where bills ought not to be killed in committee that merit discussion and are technically sound on their face.
Law enforcement, clergy, supporters, and opponents packed the gallery and House chamber with dozens of speakers, most in favor of repeal. Those who have had family members killed or have direct ties to capital cases had split opinions. Mark Bonestall, father of murdered University of Delaware student Lindsay Bonestall, said, quote, "Let the punishment fit the crime," noting that his daughter had been raped, strangled, and her body set ablaze in an effort to hide the crime. But Stuart Dotz, a juror who voted to sentence Bonestall's killer to death, says he has changed his views.
"I became a killer that day. I will always remember that fateful moment when I wrote death on a little tiny slip of paper. I was never the same again. I submit that those with no personal experience in this process fail to recognize the inconceivable burden you place on people."
Two home intruders killed Tina Leger's husband in front of her and their infant son in 1996.
"These two men are currently on death row. They are allowed to visit with their father. My son is not. They get 3 meals a day, and at times as a single mom on a state employee salary, we did not. They will be put to sleep, not murdered, in front of their family. The justice for me, my son, and their father, and the hundreds of people who decided their fate is to die."
Others, like Kristen Freilich, says that she doesn't want state-sanctioned executions to be performed in her name, even for her brother's killer. Many seeking to eliminate capital punishment cited a 2012 Cornell University study that shows a stark racial disparity among those who are sentenced to death. It found black people were more likely to receive the death penalty if they killed a white victim than if they had killed another black person. White people who killed a black victim, however, were more likely to receive a life sentence, according to the study. Lewis Police Chief Jeffrey Horvath, who represented the Police Chiefs Council, took exception to the notion that Delaware's judicial system might not be colorblind.
"Why are we looking at the race of the offender or the victim? Why aren't we looking at the individual case that applies for the death penalty? They have to meet in a certain amount of criteria to be a death penalty case. Are we saying our attorney general is a racist and he unfairly applies the death penalty?"
In the past, law enforcement had offered up amendments to the bill that would have kept capital punishment in state code if someone kills a police officer or corrections officer. A representative from the Delaware State Police said they were no longer interested in that compromise, which those sponsoring the bill say they were never interested in regardless. Lynn also cited the fiscal cost to the state, saying capital punishment cases cost Delawareans upwards of $3 million annually.
In reality, capital punishment is a bloated government program that has bogged down law enforcement, delayed justice for victims' families, and devoured millions of crime-fighting dollars that could save lives and protect the public.
Earlier in the day, supporters gathered outside of Legislative Hall, including Black Thought, a co-founder of the musical group The Roots. Lynn says he plans to suspend House rules to yank the bill to the full floor for a vote when the General Assembly reconvenes in June. He'll need 21 votes to do so amid opposition from House Speaker Pete Schwarzkopf, who's a former state trooper. Should the House pass it, Governor Jack Markell has said he will sign it into law. That nod from Markell, after 2 years of considering the issue, has given supporters hope as they view the repeal effort as a long-term issue. In past interviews, Senator Karen Peterson, who has backed all recent repeal efforts, doesn't expect her side to prevail even in the next few years. She says most movements to abolish capital punishment in states across the country have taken 8 to 10 years to be implemented. Should Lynn get the needed votes, Delaware would become the 18th state to repeal the death penalty, joining four other states that have done so in the past 6 years. James Dawson, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, James. And the death penalty debate isn't limited to the first state. With that in mind, this weekend we're bringing you a debate on this issue from NPR. It's called Abolish the Death Penalty and is an Oxford-style debate produced by Intelligence Squared US. You can hear it here Friday night at 7 on 91.1 WDDE, and again Sunday afternoon at 2 on WDDE and 91.7 WMPH in Wilmington. Of course, you can also stream it online at DelawarePublic.org. Up next on The Green, planned redevelopment of a closed steel mill will likely bring big changes to Claymont. We look at what's coming and how much say residents will have on it. This is Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Claymont has been working on redevelopment for some time now, slowly building out a major residential project, Darley Green, adding a new library, and working on streetscaping along Philadelphia Pike. But a major leap forward is anticipated if a planned redevelopment of the now-closed steel plant there goes through. This week, contributor Larry Nagengast looks at that plan in his new piece at DelawarePublic.org and how much say residents of this very distinct unincorporated area in New Castle County may have in the process. Larry also sat down with me this week to talk about it in depth, starting with the plans for that steel mill site.
What does that plan look like? It's obviously a very extensive plan for a very large property.
Well, yeah, the steel mill property started as Worth Steel in 1917 and is most recently known as Evraz Steel, and you know, in between was Phoenix Steel, Claymont Steel, City Steel, and a couple other names probably. Anyway, it's a 425-acre property, which is huge, which means that there's a room for a little bit of everything on there, and that's pretty much what CDC has in mind. Corporate center, 600,000 square feet of office space, an employment center, that means research opportunities, manufacturing, and warehousing. Transit center, a new train station for Claymont, something residents have been looking for and commuters have been looking for many years. And also, it will also have bus connections, lots of parking, and so on. A logistics center, which is another way of saying possibly a small port on the river, as well as railroad spurs and a place for trucking transfer operations. And on top of that, a big environmental cleanup, which has already started and is going to take at least 2 years while everything else seems to go through its planning process. So quite a bit there.
Despite the environmental cleanup, I mean, this is a very attractive property, correct?
It's an attractive property. You know, you take a look at where this is in Claymont. It's where I-95 and I-495 come together. Neiman's Road is right there. It fronts on the Delaware River as well, and Claymont is just a 15-minute drive from the Philadelphia International Airport. So you know, you've got train, you've got the river. You've got roads. It's really an ideal situation in that regard. Pretty much a perfect location for many businesses.
But obviously, this is something that's not going to happen overnight. You mentioned the environmental part of it. That's going to take some time. But even beyond that, this is not a quick turnaround type of project.
Oh, absolutely not. We're probably talking 10 years, maybe more. It's 10 years was the number that County Councilman John Cartier threw out at me the other day. And he mentions the Darley Green housing and retail project, which has been going on in Claymont since the Brookview apartments were torn down in 2007. So it's been 8 years, and Darley Green is still working its way through with construction in progress there. So and that was 70 acres, and this is 425. So you multiply that, do the math, and 10 years might be the earliest that you see a significant portion of this completed.
Now, unlike other small incorporated towns in Delaware that we've talked about recently, which have their own government and would thus have some kind of say in a project like this, Claymont, despite being a very distinctive area in Delaware that people are very familiar with, it is not incorporated. It has no government. So who winds up overseeing this project?
Well, that's kind of interesting. Essentially, who winds up overseeing the project? In terms of making final decisions, casting the votes, you're talking about Newcastle County Council, where Claymont is represented by John Cartier, who lives down the road from Claymont, not in Claymont. Mm-hmm. By the state legislature, there are two representatives from who serve districts that cover the Claymont area, but neither of them live in Claymont. A state senator who represents Claymont, who lives in the city of Wilmington. Bottom line here is that when the votes are counted in terms of any of the key decisions that are being made here, Claymont residents are not going to have a single vote, which doesn't mean that they're not going to have input. There are some organizations and there are ways that Claymont residents do get involved in the process.
Before we talk about that, I mean, I suppose the good news is because this is such a good project, the inclination from those who are voting on it at the different levels of government is that people are going to want this to go forward and go forward well, because what's good for Claymont is going to wind up being good for the state of Delaware and Newcastle County.
Oh, absolutely. What's good for Claymont in this case is going to be good for Newcastle County. It is going to be good for the state. Now, we don't know a whole lot in terms of the details. There's a public meeting that's scheduled next week when Claymont residents are really going to get their first detailed look at the plan. But even then, I mean, there's just going to be an awful lot of detail that has to be rolled out. Who knows what the possible port might look like, exactly where the office buildings or the warehouses, whatever, might be situated. All, those details just aren't out
traffic.
Yet. Traffic. Oh, yes, traffic. Yeah, traffic is going to be an issue, but some people say, well, it's going to be good traffic because it's going to be people coming to work and people driving down Philadelphia Pike to find a restaurant or a lunch spot or whatever. So, there are going to be some good things there as well.
But a lot to consider. And as you mentioned, there are some groups in Claymont that do hold some sway. Tell us a little bit about how, as you said, how Claymont's residents have a say in these type of things.
The key group within Claymont in terms of having input is something that's called the Design Review Advisory Committee. The acronym there is DRAC, which doesn't sound really real great, the Claymonters admit. But the DRAC is an organization that's subject to the or advises the Newcastle County Land Use Department. It was created 9 or 10 years ago when the county developed something that's called a hometown overlay, mm-hmm. which is sort of like a zoning district that covers the downtown business district, the Philadelphia Pike area of Claymont, and a little bit to either side of it. And the county has similar areas, hometown overlays in Hokes and in Centerville and in North St. George's. And the idea here is that this community group is able to give the county advice on how businesses can operate and can proceed there. It allows them to tweak the zoning rules and regs a little bit in order to maintain the community's hometown character.
Any other key players?
The other one, the really interesting one is the Claymont Renaissance organization, which was set up as this whole Claymont revitalization effort began about 10 or so years ago. And Claymont Renaissance, under its executive director, Brett Sadler, has pretty much evolved to being the sort of the go-to organization, and Sadler the go-to guy on just about anything of a political governmental nature in Claymont. Sadler is essentially the clearinghouse, and he goes to these civic association meetings and the community meetings and updates them on development issues. When people have plans and proposals, they all tend to go to Brett, and if they need help with their state legislature and a legislator and aren't quite sure how to approach it, or they have something that they want to deal with the county, they'll often consult with Brett Sadler, and he'll give them the advice on how to proceed. So in some respects, he's not really a mayor, but in some respects, he kind of operates as an informal town manager and an advisor to everybody. And things seem to be going pretty well. Cartier, the county councilman, refers to Claymont Renaissance and Brett as my community nonprofit partner. Mm. So there is a very close relationship there. There are, and it means that there are plenty of ways for Claymont residents to have their voice heard.
Having said all that, any interest in Claymont in incorporating and becoming an actual town?
Well, the short answer is right now, no. There's been some talk about it occasionally. It seems to come up every 10 or 15 years. There's a fear expressed from time to time that another level of government is going to mean more taxes, although there's really no clear way of demonstrating that, because taxation depends upon the types of services that are provided, and there are various offsets involved. But claimanters tend to not want to see another layer of government, and as long as the system that they have right now is operating pretty efficiently, if they're satisfied with the work that their state reps are doing with their county councilmen, if they've got input through organizations like the DRAC, if the county folks listen to the civic associations, then they seem to be pretty content with it the way they are. So no incorporation on the horizon for Claymont, even if it does mean that they don't have a direct say and will not have a direct say in a lot of the things that are likely to happen with the steel mill redevelopment project.
Our thanks to Larry Nagengast for his time this week. Again, his piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We look at another long-running redevelopment effort, the Wilmington Riverfront, with contributor Eileen Dalabrida next. But first, the news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. Development of Wilmington's Riverfront has been over 20 years in the making. What started with putting Frawley Stadium and Arcs Exhibition Center and outlet shops on a former industrial wasteland in the early 1990s has slowly built, changed course, and morphed into an area that finally seems to have hit critical mass with a blend of corporate offices, residential housing, restaurants, and arts and entertainment options for all ages. Contributor Eileen Dalabrida's latest piece at DelawarePublic.org looks at how the riverfront has finally seemed to hit its stride after many fits and starts and what's next in its development. And she joins us right now to talk about some more of what she learned in putting that piece together. Eileen, thanks so much for your time this week on The Green.
Good morning, Tom.
It has been quite a process to build the riverfront. I mean, I recall standing at the groundbreaking for Frawley Stadium when there was literally nothing there but mud and a few empty buildings. Because it's taken over 20 years to reach this point, where it's a much more vibrant area of town, do you think people maybe underappreciate how much transformation has actually gone on the riverfront?
Well, when I was on the riverfront recently, and I was talking with people, and people who were there with small children who would never have brought kids down there many, many years ago because it was kind of dicey, they were amazed. And when they see that there are a lot of different things to do, that they're coming back and becoming regulars.
And you mentioned kids, and that was one thing that maybe wasn't necessarily part of the original vision for riverfront development, those kid-friendly venues, maybe other than the stadium and the Blue Rocks. You know, now, as you mentioned, there are families with kids there. They visit the Children's Museum. They have the new trampoline park there. They're still going to have the miniature golf there along with the Children's Museum. What has kind of been the responsible for the transformation of this area into a very kid-friendly type of spot?
Well, it was very important to get the Children's Museum. It's the only one in the state. But what really put the riverfront over the top in terms of being a family-friendly destination was the theater. It's the next closest IMAX theater is in King of Prussia, and the Penn Cinema has 14 screens. So a lot of people come down and to go to a movie, and then they look around and they see restaurants and other attractions, and they just start branching out from there. But the theater was really key. You can see the signage from I-95. It's very prominent, and so there are hundreds of thousands of cars that go by every day that say, "Oh wow, there's an IMAX here."
Yeah, I was curious about that because in your piece from the Riverfront Development Corporation, Megan McGlinchey had pointed to the IMAX Theater as kind of a tipping point to reaching this kind of point of critical mass. And I guess in some ways that, you know, for someone like myself who's kind of followed this since the early 90s, it seems almost surprising that's been the tipping point, that it's not the Westin Hotel or some other bigger project, but it's something as basic as a movie theater. Is that because it really does generate maybe the most regular traffic to the riverfront?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, Tom. It brings repeat business, and it also helps the other venues down there. You know, we've talked about Frawley Stadium, that was like really, really always family friendly, a great place to take kids, and wonderful Friday night fireworks. But you know, that's only part of the year, and people would come to the stadium, they would get in their cars, and they would drive back, and there was nothing else to bring them down. With the theater, theaters are open 365 days a year, day and night, and it really does generate a lot of traffic.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, a Blue Rocks game, maybe parents are going to take their kids to one or two games a year. Maybe they're going to visit the Children's Museum a handful of times a year. But a movie theater really is that kind of constant flow of people, and particularly, obviously, young people, not just very young kids, but obviously up into that teenage and young adult years.
Yeah, it's it is a big draw, and it's a quality theater. It's a great place to go and see movies.
Yeah, now, as you mentioned in your piece, not everything on the riverfront has been a success, and we mentioned at the top the outlet shopping was part of the original plan. It did not fare very well. Is there a sense from the key players you talked to that particular failure maybe helped them learn a little bit about what they needed to do in the riverfront and what would actually work to bring people there?
I think so. I mean, the shopping, the management of the RDC said that it was a kind of a cul-de-sac place, and they felt that was not compatible with retail. Now it's offices. They're 95% leased. It's you know, people work there, so it's been. And I also think that fashions change. At the time when that was a retail operation, they were outlet stores, and outlets weren't really very popular with consumers then. So I think that that timing and location and all those factors are things that when you're trying to do something as ambitious as develop the Wilmington Riverfront are things that you learn from and you contemplate and move on.
We talked a little bit briefly about the Westin Hotel being brought in recently and that being a big step forward in establishing the district as a conference destination paired with the Chase Center, the former Arts Center turned into a conference center. Just give us a little idea of how that marriage of the Westin and the conference center, the Chase Center, is working. And is it doing what they envisioned it would do?
It's been a really, really fruitful relationship. And the people who from the Greater Wilmington Visitors and Convention Bureau say that it's been great for the city at large, because when you have this one-stop destination where people are going to a conference and they can stay in a hotel that actually adjoins it, it's ideal. It's ideal. And then they can walk to restaurants. They can come in on the train. It's logistically, it's a slam dunk.
You mentioned in your piece that the residential rental market on the riverfront has also heated up. Who is running there and why?
Well, I think overall rentals are very hot. And so when you have this critical mass of these nice new apartments that have a lot of amenities, I think that's a recipe for success. There are some families, you do see the school bus come and pick up small children, but primarily it's young professionals. And some of them work at various places on the riverfront, large employers like AAA and Barclaycard and Capital One, and others are commuters. They hop the train to Philadelphia.
And just to wrap things up, let's take a look at the future a little bit. The Riverfront Development Corporation recently bought back the Riverfront Market. What's going on there with that market, and how is that going to change and maybe start to fit into this concept of Riverfront Development?
It's a very cool property, an old warehouse. And the traffic has not been great there. One of the things that they're going to do is just enhance the venue, new flooring, new lighting, and to try to rebrand it as a breakfast destination. Lunch and dinner are hopping, but there is not a critical mass in terms of venues where people can get breakfast. And that seems to be a good fit in districts where there are a lot of working people.
All right. Contributor Eileen Dalambrito, we thank you so much for your time on The Green this week.
Thanks, Tom.
And a reminder, you can read Eileen's piece on Wilmington Riverfront and its development right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next up on The Green, we look at a local program tied to President Obama's Tech Hire Initiative, a new campaign designed to get Americans more rapidly trained for high-paying tech jobs. Stay with us. This is Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Back in March, President Obama announced a new initiative called Tech Hire. It's a new campaign designed to get Americans more rapidly trained for high-paying tech jobs. The tech sector continually adds jobs to the economy, but doesn't have enough applicants to fill vacancies. The Obama administration highlighted 20 communities that are already taking the lead, communities that are training students without a college degree for well-paying tech careers. Among them was Tech Impact, a Delaware and Pennsylvania-based organization which offers this training at no cost to students. Delaware Public Media's Ann Hoffman has more on what they're doing.
Matavia Porter used to make music videos for local Delaware artists. She says the pay was sporadic and unstable, so she decided to trade the freelance life for a career in technology. When I caught up with her a few weeks ago, she was breaking down a complex concept to her fellow classmates in their intensive 16-week certificate program. The concept at hand was how smartphones know where their users are. The answer has to do with something called an accelerometer.
Any questions?
How does the accelerometer pick up the movements? How does it know, like, which way that you're...
Oh, senses. It does something with the Earth's gravitational pull. Yeah. So it's some extra next level physics stuff going on there. I don't know.
That answer Matavia gave is a great example of how she operates. She's one of those people who takes in information quickly and can put it into her own words.
I can catch on to things like that. I'm very analytical in my thinking, so this kind of stuff like keeps me going because I like having to research and, you know, come to that understanding.
She says her program, part of the local organization Tech Impact, also provides a lot of support. The curriculum is online, and her teacher has had friends donate professional clothes for student interviews. After the program concludes, successful students will get placed in an internship with one of several organizations, like Capital One or Barclays.
And it's really amazing because when you look at the job description for a job like that, they want people with bachelor's degrees to do these positions, and we're just coming out of this program with certificates, and those companies, they want us. They're seeking after us.
Programs like Tech Impact aim to prepare non-traditional candidates for careers in tech by giving students the specific skills big companies look for. And that's important because the landscape of who works in tech isn't very diverse, captured succinctly by the HBO show Silicon Valley.
That's weird. They always travel in groups of five.
These programmers, there's always a tall, skinny white guy,
short, skinny Asian guy, fat guy with a ponytail, some guy with crazy facial hair, and then an East Indian guy. It's like they trade guys until they all have the right group.
Not only is Matavia an African-American woman, which is a demographic poorly represented in tech fields. At Google, for instance, it's just 1% of the overall workforce. She barely graduated from high school. She didn't go to college and definitely didn't host LAN parties with her fellow techie friends in the suburbs.
Certainly, there's this perception of what you need to have when you're coming into a technology career.
That's Anthony Pisapia, Associate Executive Director of Tech Impact.
When we look at it, we see technologists who are very successful, who have high school diplomas, who never completed college, never completed a degree. My own experience is my father went that route. He, high school graduate, became very successful in IT. So what we see is absolutely a myth. And perception is not reality. And part of our challenge is waking folks up to the fact that there is this opportunity.
Pisapia says there are certain factors that can be insurmountable obstacles for some students. Things like strong literacy skills that enable them to write a good cover letter or send a well-worded email. The other piece is soft skills, like knowing how to get along with others well and how to ace an interview. TechHire devotes a lot of time to helping students in these areas as well. And since tech is the one sector of the U.S. economy that is consistently growing, Pisapia says investing resources in training non-traditional students is deeply worthwhile. In Matavia's case, she'll complete a quality assurance internship at Capital One, which will entail entry-level help desk-type work. But she'll have opportunities to move up, and she's interested in taking a coding bootcamp in the fall offered by Tech Impact. For now, instead of making minimum wage or getting paid inconsistently for freelance work, if all goes well, Matavia will clear around $50,000 a year.
Being able to provide not just a job, but a career and a way to start that that doesn't necessarily require going into tremendous amounts of debt is a good thing.
That's Sandy Behrens, who sits on the board of directors for Tech Impact. Back in 1990, she went through the same kind of program Matavia is in now. It was called MOST, or Minority Skills Opportunity Training, and run out of the state of New Jersey. She was one of 25 people selected from a huge pool of applicants. Like Matavia, Behrens didn't have a college degree. She was also young and African-American, and on top of all that, a new mom. Behrens says she didn't do well in high school because the curriculum was too rigid for the way that she learns best.
I have to do things very singularly. But the upshot of that is that once I learn something and I incorporate it, it usually doesn't fall from my head.
In the MOST program, Behrens excelled. And it turns out that her style of learning is actually a huge asset when it comes to tech work.
I can understand that this thing over here is inherently connected to this thing over here.
Behrens says that allows her to see things from a bird's eye view, which makes her an adept software engineering manager. Now Behrens is successful in tech and serves as a mentor for students like Matavia. She says the best thing she can provide is one-on-one support. Matavia is starting her new internship in 2 weeks, and she says whatever challenges she encounters in this new environment, she'll be able to handle.
You know, I don't let my present circumstances choose my future. You know, if I want to get a job in these corporate companies, I look at what I need to do, what are they looking for, and I become that person. So you got to be adaptable.
For Delaware Public Media, I'm Ann Hoffman.
Thanks, Sam. And stay with us on The Green. Our Kathy Carter brings us this week's arts playlist and Enlighten Me next, introducing us to the Capitol Ringers and taking us back in time in Bowers Beach. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. Many people may be familiar with handbells from church, but the Capitol Ringers play everything from the sacred to the secular. The Dover-based ensemble features an impressive set of handbells with 6 octaves, or 73 bells, played by multiple ringers. Their performances often include a multimedia component with a projector displaying film clips behind them. In the case of their new show, concertgoers will see lots of clips from movies and performances from The Great White Way. In this week's arts playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter chats with the Capitol Ringers artistic director, Linda Sims, about their new show, Broadway to Hollywood.
Linda Sims, you're the artistic director of the Capitol Ringers. Can you give us a little brief synopsis of the history of the organization?
Sure. In 2004, I met with several ringers in the Dover area, thinking that this would be an organization that would be predominantly drawing from the Dover region, and met with those ringers to see if there was enough interest in order to start a community handbell ensemble, knowing that a community handbell ensemble would be unique as compared to the church choirs that we have, that we would have the opportunity to ring secular music, not just sacred music, and to be able to combine the community of ringers so that we're actually diversifying ourselves membership-wise, so that we are bringing a larger, greater community together through the passion of handbells and performing on those.
What are some of the musical genres that you have taken up over the years?
Well, I think the most interesting thing has been to be able to do some of the pop pieces, the popular top 40 hits, some of the rock and roll pieces that have been arranged for handbells, from Beatles to Beach Boys and Adele and Carly Rae Jepsen and a lot of the pop things, with the hope that some of our younger generations would start to identify handbells as kind of a cool thing to do, doesn't have to be in church, and to demonstrate the diversity of what this instrument can really do.
And the Capitol Ringers are currently doing a spring tour. You've already played a bunch of shows. And this season, you're doing a show called Broadway to Hollywood.
Yeah, how fun is that, you know? I love it. It's been a lot of fun for us to be able to resurrect some of the melodies that you know we've all enjoyed when we've watched the Disney movies. So you've got Lion King and Pirates of the Caribbean and Little Mermaid represented in our show, along with a lot of great tunes from some of our shows on Broadway, like Phantom of the Opera. And then we're back to the movies again with Lord of the Rings. So big diversity of melodies that we've been able to find that are arranged for handbells. A lot of fun to play.
Now, when you were designing the pieces for this particular show, what kind of things were you looking for? You mentioned you did The Lion King and that sort of thing, but what about the music that said, yeah, this is a piece that I think is going to be so fun to do?
Well, it has to captivate the ringers. We have to have something that's challenging, that is not mundane. There are a lot of arrangements that we've played before or we've tried before that were kind of boring or not as exciting to play. The melody was certainly there, but the texture of the piece was not very thick. It was not challenging. There are a lot of techniques that we used in handbells, not just ringing. So I'm also looking for a variety of techniques that are challenging to perform and give that interesting sound when we're performing each piece.
What are some of those techniques?
A lot of people don't recognize that underneath the covers of our tables are 4 or 5 inch pads, foam rubber pads. And so we are able to actually strike the bell into the pad that gives sort of a perfunctory sound. Many musicians would understand as being like a stopped sound. It's like staccato or an accent. We shake the bells. We actually have another unique technique that we are debuting in this tour called an aqua bend, where we ring the bell, grab the clapper, that's the little portion that's inside that hits the outside casting of the bell. We grab the clapper and dip the bell in water. And I'm sure anyone who rings bells and is listening to this is gasping, because we know that we don't put moisture on bells, but I assure you we wipe them down very, very quickly after that. And it gives kind of a unique wah, wah, wah sound at the end. That's a fun thing, and audiences have been just going crazy over that because it's really, it's unique, it's different.
So we talked a lot about technique and the ringing, but I understand there's a visual component as well.
Absolutely. Several years ago, we had the opportunity to add some visual presentation along with that. So our backdrop is a portable screen, a large portable screen. So we are able to include animations, video clips from different things. And uniquely, this particular show, Broadway to Hollywood, is using the photography of one of our local Dover photographers, whose name is Stephanie Seaman. And Stephanie was on Facebook. I happened to see her work and thought, how cool would it be to combine and do a collaboration with a local photographer? And we are using her beautiful photographs of the wildlife in Delaware, from Bombay Hook to Prime Hook, the many different locations on our Delaware Bay. And we're using those as our backdrop for What a Wonderful World. And it's stunning.
It's not your grandmother's handbell concert.
No, it's not. And that's, I'm glad you said that, because that's exactly what we want everyone to understand. And I think they'll see that when they come and see for themselves.
Our thanks to Linda Sims, artistic director for the Capitol Ringers. The ensemble performs Saturday night at the Smyrna Opera House and Sunday, May 31st, at Epworth United Methodist Church in Rehoboth Beach. And we turn again to our Kathy Carter for this week's Enlighten Me. She takes us to Bowers Beach, where scallywags, swashbucklers, and other assorted pirates invade Memorial Day weekend. The annual Buccaneer Bash features a treasure hunt, sword fights, and a pirate ship complete with cannons. There is a Friday night pub crawl, and there will be cruises on the Delaware Bay, where French, Spanish, and Dutch ships once boldly sailed searching for booty. While organizers of the Buccaneer Bash say they want guests to party like it's $16.99, there is a larger mission here. The weekend also marks the grand reopening of the Bowers Beach Maritime Museum, which aims to educate people about the history of Bowers Beach. In this week's Enlighten Me, Kathy introduces us to one of the people who lived that history.
One of the earliest settlements along the Delaware Bay, Bowers Beach is nestled between the mouths of the St. Jones and Murderkill Rivers. The town was once one of the state's premier fishing regions, with an average of 300 boats at its docks. Charlie Irons grew up in Bowers Beach. His father was a waterman, and he says his childhood was pretty idyllic.
It may sound kind of corny, but the town, like most small towns that you would find in the United States back in the 50s or the 40s, 50s, and 60s, the fire company was the backbone of the community, which you would find in any small community in the state of Delaware. We had a small grocery store. You had kids playing in the street. You had your baseball teams. You had your Boy Scout troop. And the best thing was, growing up there, if you got in trouble, your parents knew it before you got home, because everybody knew everybody's kids, you know.
During Bowers Beach heyday, watermen routinely harvested Delaware Bay oysters, commonly called white gold.
And what they would do, they would take oyster shells from the oyster house, they would grind them up in the shell mill, and then they put it in chicken feed. And they also mixed it with something else that most people in Delaware are familiar with. It's called, we call them king crabs, but they're really, it's a horseshoe crab. You would grind them up and use that with the oyster shells for chicken feed. And that was a big, big business. I know when I was young, we used to get a penny apiece for pulling king crabs out of the water. We would, in the summertime, we would work the fishing party boats. We would either mate on them. You go out with the party boat captains, take care of the bait. You help the customer, the fishing party. You put the hooks on, you put the bait on, take their fish off. And you're working for tips is what you're doing. You get back in, and in those days, in the 50s, you would run what we call double hitter. You'd leave in the morning at 7 o'clock. You'd be back in the dock by 1, scrub the boat down, refuel it, put bait on it, and turn around and go right back out again, and come back in at 9 o'clock. And to give you some idea, in 1952, I was away. My father wrote me a letter. He had a fishing party that had 9 people on board. They went out in Delaware Bay and what we call the Oyster Grounds, which is south of Bowers, and he had caught over 1,100 trout and was back in the dock by 12 o'clock. you could take all the fish they catch in a year down there, now you won't come up to 1,100.
But back when Charlie was a boy, Bowers Beach was all about fishing. He and his buddies often went out on the water at night. They would tie up to the 14-foot bank lighthouse, a privilege Coast Guard workers allowed with a little enticement.
And you'd always take some liquid refreshment, and they would throw a basket over with a rope. You put the liquid refreshment in the basket, they jack it up, and they would let you tie up to the lighthouse. You'd throw an anchor off, run up, tie off to the lighthouse, wait for the change of tide, and you catch these trout called tide runners. Now, a tide runner to a stranger is a trout, and they run about 30 to 35 inches long, and they raise about 20 to 22 pounds. Huge fish, I mean huge. What you would do, you take a Coleman lantern over the side of the boat, and you wait, and you would start seeing minnows come up in the water. And then all of a sudden, you'll see a flash of a big white thing going through it. This was squid. The squid was chasing the minnows. And then, boy, after that, out of the deep, you see the big tide runners coming up, chasing the squid. It was a good time to grow up, I'll put it that way.
By the 1970s, many watermen had abandoned Bowers Beach after harvesting restrictions and disease had caused the town's oyster industry to lose its luster.
The period of time that I grew up, and then the kids that followed me, their time period was entirely different because they didn't get to experience the things that I did. And the ones that are down there now, they don't get to experience any of it. Bowers has turned into a community of retired people, which is great. It's just another phase of a town that it's going through. That's all.
In fact, the boatyard where Charlie Irons once worked has been converted to housing for the town's burgeoning baby boom retirees.
That boatyard now has condominiums in it. And those condominiums, they sell for $200,000. There are homes down on the beachfront now that are $500,000, $700,000 a piece. When I was raised in Bowers Beach, you could have bought the town for that much money. You know, it's another phase that the town is going through. Is it good? Yeah, it's good. Because the industry's gone. The kids that grew up at Bowers moved away, started their lives in the city or somewhere else because there's nothing for them there. And so it's become a retirement community, which is great. It's good.
These days, people come to Bowers Beach to swim, birdwatch, and kayak. And beginning Memorial Day weekend, Delawareans can get a glimpse at its past with the grand reopening of the Bowers Beach Maritime Museum.
This year, the staff of the museum, of which I'm just a volunteer, but they made contact with an individual up in Pennsylvania that has a 35-foot pirate vessel that they're bringing down to the beach. It has four cannons on it. It'll be on a full sail. And just no joke, it's the truth. That is going to be great for the kids. And they do get to sing pirate songs. They put patches over their eyes. But it all helps promote the town, to promote the museum. It will show different phases of the business at Bowers, the oyster and the fishing and the trapping and the boat maintenance and what the people did. It'll show that. There'll also be an area for children. And for the new part, now we got the pirates, you know. So there's a little bit for everybody.
Our thanks to Charlie Irons for enlightening us this week. The Buccaneer Bash and grand reopening of the Bowers Beach Maritime Museum are on tap over Memorial Day weekend, May 22nd through the 24th. And that'll do it for this week's edition of The Green. A reminder, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. If you have comments about this week's show or story ideas for future shows, contact us via our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors Eileen Dalabrida and Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter, James Dawson, Ann Hoffman, and Carl Malgiro, as well as our station manager, Casey Houts. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.